So, as Kathy said, I am both a patient and a physician, so I think I share a unique perspective that hopefully can help shed some light on the issues of coping with a chronic illness, which is often a pretty significant hurdle. All right, so believe it or not, as of 2012, half of all adults had one or more chronic conditions. So if you extend that out a little bit, pretty much everybody in the world lives with or at least knows somebody with a chronic illness. So this is something that touches a lot of people. And as all of you know, there are lots of physical challenges that come with this and also a lot of psychological issues as well. All right, so what is it that's so unique about immune deficiencies? Well, for one thing, they're very difficult to understand. Just think about the last time you tried to explain to somebody what was wrong with you. People's eyes just kind of glaze over. They have no idea what you're talking about. I'm now celebrating the 30th year since my diagnosis and the start of my treatment. And back when I was first diagnosed, you know, the big question was, so do you have AIDS? Well, no. But other than that, I was like, yeah, but I don't really know what else to tell you other than that. So immune deficiencies are difficult to understand. They're, for the most part, invisible. Most of us walking around would not know who's the patient, who's the spouse, who's the family, who's the friend. And so there's nothing about us that readily jumps out at people and says, oh yeah, hey, you've got an immune deficiency. Changes in identity now that I have this illness. Unpredictability and uncertainty about the future with the addition of diagnoses over time. I would say if we actually surveyed most people with a primary immune deficiency, most people do not just have a primary immune deficiency. They have lots of other complications that go along with it. And for those of you who went to the CVID talk this morning, you learned a lot about those. Lots of trouble with disappointing ourselves and others over time, unable to keep commitments that you would like to be keeping. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And for those of you who are prospective parents, there are very real genetic concerns. What does this mean for my future children? Am I likely to transmit this? So these are all big deals. All right, so one of the basic questions I think we all need to think about is it all comes down to when I'm thinking about how I'm feeling, am I sick? Am I tired? Am I depressed? Am I anxious? Or am I all of the above? And what I want to do today is I want to talk a little bit about, okay, how do you know the difference? All right, so first of all, let's talk about depression. So these are the official diagnostic criteria for depression. I'm surprised when I see patients in my office and I say, well, have you been feeling depressed? And the patients say, well, I don't know, what does that mean? So what that means is, and we're not talking about a day at a time, every human on the planet has a bad day. But what we're talking about is a period of day after day, perhaps for weeks or months or longer, feeling sad or down, definitely losing interest in things. That's a big sign of depression. People who are depressed either gain a lot of weight or lose a lot of weight sometimes. Sleep disturbance. Again, this can go either way, just like appetite. People often sleep way too much and escape when they're feeling depressed, or they're not able to sleep enough. Problems with feeling agitated, restless, having to move, or just being such a slug you just can't get up and get going. Fatigue or loss of energy, I'll talk a little bit about that later. That's a little bit more complicated, and unlike some of the speakers this morning, I do have some ideas about how to treat that. Feelings of worthlessness or guilt. And what that means is, you know, I just feel like I'm such a burden to my family. Maybe I'd be better off dead. You know, aren't people sick of hearing about my problems? So feelings of worthlessness or guilt. Difficulty paying attention. You go to read a book and you find that you read the same page of the book over and over and you still can't remember what you read. trouble making decisions. You go to the grocery store and you're trying to decide what cereal to buy, and it just seems overwhelming. You know, you can't even make a basic decision about a breakfast cereal. And most concerning of all is thoughts about death or suicide. And where that, what I would like to say, and I get this question all the time, is, so it's not okay for somebody to have suicidal thoughts sometime? I think if we were really honest with ourselves and with each other, there have been very bad points in everybody's life where maybe you think about, oh man, you know, it'd just be so much easier if I just gave up. You know, I just don't know how much more of this I can take. That is not so much the concern. What's more of a concern is if you start thinking about how you might kill yourself, when you might kill yourself, you start writing letters. Those are signs of a medical emergency. So that's kind of how you tell the difference between, okay, what's being a human versus what's a significant depression problem that needs treatment. All right, so doctors and patients both participate in the obstacles to diagnosis. I hear this all the time because I work with medically ill patients. Whenever doctors see something bad, you know, somebody loses a limb, somebody's having to have multiple surgeries, doctors will often say, oh, well, yeah, you know, if I had that, I'd be depressed too. And so depression may be viewed as expected. Or, you know, if somebody's terminally ill, they say, oh, well, you know, they're dying, of course they're depressed. That's not really actually the case. There are a lot of terminally ill people who are not depressed. There are a lot of people with major medical issues who are also not depressed. But doctors are often a little biased and think it maybe makes sense for you to be depressed and not do anything as a result of it. I work in the world's largest medical center. We are ultra subspecialized. And so I work primarily with patients with liver disease, and I hear every day patients talk about how the doctors only talk about my liver. My liver's better, worse, the same. They don't talk about the person carting the liver around and what it must be like to live with that. Doctors, I think they're better about this, but a lot of doctors are still also very afraid of offending patients by recommending they seek mental health counseling or see a psychiatrist. Doctors don't want to upset the patients. Patients are often reluctant to ask for help because they don't want to look needy. They want to be the perfect patient, and you know, maybe that might make them look flawed if they ask for some extra help. Patients are often afraid that if they were to seek psychiatric treatment, their medical issues would be dismissed. I would argue that a good doctor should be able to look at both. Fear of expensive psychiatric treatment. One of the big benefits of healthcare reform is it's making psychiatric treatment more accessible than ever. Also, in each community, there are free or sliding scale resources for psychiatric treatment. So I don't think expense should put psychiatric treatment out of reach for anybody. All right, so one of the complicating things about depression is there are lots of medical causes of it. I won't go through all of these, but I'll just hit some of the high points. So many people with primary immune deficiencies also have autoimmune problems, which can mean include hypothyroidism and things like that as well. Hypothyroidism can look exactly like depression. Other autoimmune diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis can have problems with depression, asthma, diabetes. Different nutritional deficiencies can also play a role. And then patients who have had heart attacks or strokes are also very high risk for depression. Just like medical problems can cause depression, medications can cause depression. In particular, antibiotics like Cipro can be associated with depression. We don't use it as much anymore due to newer treatments, but for hepatitis C, we used to use interferon a lot, and that was associated with profound depression. Some cardiac drugs, some anxiety and pain medicines, all of these can be associated with depression. So what exactly does this mean for you? Well, it depends on the severity of the depression. If you have very severe depression, and you have an infection that is treated by multiple antibiotic choices, what that would mean is that Cipro might not be my first choice for treating your infection if we have other options. But this is all a balancing act, and so it's a discussion that you need to have with your doctor. So depression is one of the most common complications of all chronic illnesses. Up to one-third of people with serious medical illnesses experience symptoms of depression. As I said, regardless of how bad your medical condition is, depression is not a normal part of it. Depression is a separate illness that deserves treatment. Treating depression results in better quality of life. It improves compliance. Think about when you felt really bad or down, how hard it is to stick with your medicines like you're supposed to. And in some disease states, particularly in patients who are listed for liver transplant, there's actually been recent studies that show that people who are treated for depression actually have an improved chance of surviving. So it's really worthwhile to get this treated. Most people respond to treatment for depression very well, and it can make a huge difference in your life. Lots of different causes of depression and chronic illness. I'll just hit on a few. Pain, stress on social relationships, not being able to do things you want to do. Patient-doctor conflicts, I'll spend a little bit more time talking about later. It's actually one of my favorite topics, and it's also how I spend a good deal of my day because patients are very frustrated with their physicians. Having a chronic illness like a primary immune deficiency can often result in a feeling of loss of control, loss of financial stress, uncertainty about the future. Fatigue is also something I'll talk about later, and also some of the medicines, again, have psychiatric side effects. All right, so how do you know when you need treatment for depression? Well, probably the first and the last are about the best. If your symptoms impair functioning, if you can't get out of bed and go to work and do what you need to do every day, or you can't take care of your family, you're not compliant with your treatment, all of that would suggest those are signs that you need to get some professional help. The last thing I list is suicidal thoughts. Clearly, if you're having suicidal thoughts, that's a sign of a psychiatric emergency and you need to get help right away. Another sign is your use of illicit drugs, marijuana, other stuff off the street, prescription drugs increases, or your amount of alcohol that you normally consume increases. So these are some of the warning signs that you need to get some help. How do we treat depression? Usually it's best to treat it with a combination of psychotherapy, which means talking to somebody, and medications. Some of the psychological treatments for depression that you can actually do it yourself. There's an excellent workbook called Mind Over Mood. This is not the kind of book that you're going to like download on your Kindle and plow through tonight. This is a book that really requires a commitment to really work through the workbook. But for the vast majority of people, if you make the investment of time and working through this workbook, it will help you. Journaling, support groups, I'll talk a little bit about later on. Writing, volunteering. Okay, I just have to do my public service announcement about swimming. Many of you who have read my Fox News article know all about this already. But people with primary immune deficiencies need to be very cautious about swimming in public pools. 3 years ago, I had a life-threatening ear infection as a result of swimming. I still have a drain in my neck as a result of swimming. I've had 3 surgeries, including a neurological surgery. And I'm still on IV antibiotics 3 years later from swimming in a pool that my immunologist and I handpicked. So what I would say is if you or your kids have primary immune deficiencies and you're really set on swimming, please see an ENT and get ear molds made. I am profoundly deaf on the left side as a result of this, and we are not sure if this will ever really get better. So please be very careful with swimming. So anyway, that's the biggest downer of the whole talk, so let's perk it up. All right, pets, surfing the net. If you surf the net in a good way. There's a lot of bad stuff on the internet. So for me, happiness is a warm beagle, so here's my therapy. All right, So let's talk a little bit about other treatments for depression. There are some patients for medical reasons who antidepressants are not appropriate. I won't bore you with the details, but they're sort of a long list. Antidepressants are not completely benign treatments. If somebody is severely depressed, we need an immediate fix. Say this person has a life-threatening depression, they're not eating, they're not moving, they're not participating in any of their medical treatment, we need to fix it. Now, we often use stimulants, like Ritalin. We use it in very low dose, they're very safe, they work very quickly. And if I have a patient who is terminally ill but is very depressed, and I may not have time for an antidepressant to work, I'll use a stimulant. I give a first dose of a stimulant tomorrow morning. By noon, they're better. So those are also some other options. Okay, so in several of the talks I went to today, they talk about how fatigue is part of a primary immune deficiency, but we aren't really sure why. We aren't really sure what to do about it. Well, here's what you can ask your doctor about. These are things you do for fatigue. There are two medicines on the market that are wake promoting agents. Patients hear me say that and they think I say weight promoting, like, oh my God, I don't want to get fat. Well, it's not, we're not making you fat, it's about keeping you awake. It has nothing to do with weight. So Nuvigil and Provigil, they would be prescribed off-label, but they can help with fatigue due to medical illnesses. I prescribe these a lot for my medically ill patients. Insurance coverage is often an issue. But these medicines can be very helpful, and there's copay cards and such to help. All right, so in summary, let's talk about medication management of depression. So if you were to hear this talk and go see a psychiatrist, you need to make sure that they know all about your medications, all about your medical history. Because if you have liver disease, kidney disease, heart disease, it would change the way I would manage you. And so your doctor really needs to know about all of that. Also, take that list of symptoms of depression and identify the target symptoms. You know, even print off this talk and say, hey, I went to this talk and I have these five symptoms. And this is actually what bothers me the most. Because antidepressants are not one size fits all, and depending on what we're treating, we may choose one medicine over the other. And that's what I mean by side effects or fringe benefits. There are some medicines that help you sleep. People who are couch potatoes and very lethargic don't want that. They need more of a boost in energy. So think about what your target symptoms are so that can help your doctor pick a treatment. All right, so one of the biggest keys to being psychologically healthy with a chronic illness, I believe, is really having a purpose. My purpose is to help people cope with chronic illnesses better, and that is what gets me out of bed every day, and I'm very fortunate to be one of the people who really and truly love what I do. I think part of it is living because of something instead of living in spite of our illness. For the vast majority of people, I think they belong in the workplace. And if you can't work with some sort of modifications, I think it's really important to volunteer. My patients, regardless of what's wrong with them, my patients who do the very best are those that have a reason to get out of bed every morning. I know if somebody took my work away from me and I just had to stay home all day, I think that would be horribly depressing. So I think it's really important to have a purpose. All right, so let's shift gears a little bit and talk about anxiety. So what is anxiety, actually? It can be described a bunch of different ways. It can be a feeling of stress, tension, feeling uptight. You feel like your fuse is shorter. Everything's getting on your nerves. You just snap at people. Maybe you're a worrier who just kind of stays on this treadmill in your brain and you can't get off. And even though you know worrying about something isn't going to fix it, you can't quit worrying. Feelings of nervousness, panic attacks. Maybe you get short of breath or your heart races or you feel like you're suddenly going to die and you stay home as a result of it because you're afraid of that happening again. Anxiety, just like depression, has lots of medical problems or lots of medical causes. thyroid problems, particularly if you're on too much thyroid replacement or your thyroid is overactive. That can cause anxiety. Heart disease like atrial fibrillation makes people very anxious. I listed heart disease twice. Sorry about that. Asthma, substance abuse, or withdrawing from substances of abuse. Medications, particularly patients who are on high-dose steroids, can get profoundly anxious. So I really believe that knowledge is power, and this is particularly important with people like us who have rare diseases. The vast majority of physicians have no idea what it is we have. And so it's important that we learn about our illness to be able to be our best advocate. It's also important to communicate effectively with your healthcare team, and I'll talk about this in a bit. Medication treatments for anxiety, there are lots of different options. Sometimes we use antidepressants. Sometimes we use specific medicines like Ativan or Klonopin for anxiety. These have some addiction potential, and so you have to be careful about that. And Buspar is a particular medicine specifically for anxiety, particularly people who are worriers. It doesn't work often, but when it works, for some people it works very well. Beta blockers are often used for performance anxiety. So say somebody's very anxious about giving a talk or an attorney's anxious about going to trial. A beta blocker helps block the physical symptoms of anxiety. A few little things about anxiety management. The big things are limit caffeine, get adequate sleep. Patients who have really bad insomnia and they've got a really bad sleep-wake cycle, I often see that their anxiety gets much worse. Turn off the TV at night. Don't stay awake watching the news before you go to bed. In Houston, it's just a kind of a list of who got murdered that day, and I don't really think it does much to relax anybody. For people who are bad worriers, I literally recommend setting aside an hour a day to worry. So what that means is you do nothing else, and you say from 9 to 10, okay, I'm just going to sit and make a list of what I need to worry about, and that is your day, that is your time to worry, and when that hour is over, you say, okay, done. And then you aren't allowed to worry the rest of the day. Believe it or not, for some people it really works. All right, anxieties.com is an excellent website. Highly recommend it. Let's talk a little bit about doctor-patient issues. So I am not kidding, and I'm sure you guys believe this. Throughout my work day, a lot of people say, hey, you know what? We've done a really pretty good job on treating my depression and anxiety. My biggest stress is dealing with Dr. So-and-so. So let's talk a little bit about how to deal with your doctor most effectively. So as we know, doctor's visits are very short. Doctors have their agenda. Patients have their own agenda. So how do you really optimize that time? For one thing, take an updated written medication list. My assistant always calls and confirms appointments and says, please bring an updated written medication list. And patients will come and they'll be like, yeah, I didn't remember to write that down, but you know, I'm on something that my ENT started for allergies. And so we spend a lot of time trying to kind of dream up this medication list that really the time could have been spent more effectively if it was written down. Provide a brief summary of your current symptoms. I'm sure we have all had periods of time when we've eagerly awaited a doctor's appointment and we think, oh, yes, I finally get to see her. And then you get there and you forget to mention something because maybe you aren't having that issue at the current moment. And you've waited a month for this appointment and just missed your opportunity because you didn't have that written down. For me, I see multiple other doctors, and so what I try to do is I try to summarize what my ENT said. I try to summarize what my infectious disease doctor said, so that way everybody kind of knows what the plan is from everybody else. Identify the appropriate doctor for a particular issue. I get calls about patients' toenail funguses, and that is not my best thing. And so I usually just say, well, call your PCP. I really have no clue. Prepare a short list of questions. I have seen this work very effectively. If you have a written list of two or three questions, and you tell the doctor as they stand up and they're getting ready to walk out the door, if you say, I have three questions, then it would be really obnoxious for a doctor to keep walking out the door. And that could potentially be one of many signs you need a new doctor. But a lot of doctors, if you define how many questions you have and you have them written down, the doctor will stand there and listen to you. It's an experiment we're trying. I've seen it worked very well. Request any letters or refills you need during the appointment. It just keeps the nurses and everybody else happy, and it's very important to keep your nurses happy, by the way. All right, here are just a few websites I like about chronic illness on the web. All of them have their pros and cons, but they're kind of things that I like. All right, let's talk briefly about how you find psychiatric help. And
can you go back real quick, Kate?
Is this all available online? Or will they?
Do you agree to?
Yes.
Yes.
Everybody can have all of this.
Yes, and I think what will happen is there will be a link that will be sent to you, and then you'll be able to go there and look at any of the presentations from the conference that.
Okay.
Okay, that's perfect.
I know. Yeah. I know. I've been picturing all day.
I have no intention of depriving anybody. And there's a lot of information here that I think you might want to study later. All right, so let's say you've heard this talk or you've been thinking and you're like, okay, yeah, I need some help, but how in the world do I find it? Well, one good source is ask your physician. If you have a physician that you trust, they often have consultants that they like. So, for example, if a patient comes to me and says, hey, I need a lung doctor, okay, I have a mental list of who the lung doctors are I like and respect. Okay, the same is likely true of psychiatrists. Check with the local branch of your mental health association. They may have some ideas. Insurance provider panels may be an important way to go, especially if you want to use your insurance. A lot of mental health professionals are self-pay and quite expensive. If you live near a medical school, use the local school's medical school psychiatry department. They often have sliding scales. And you see residents who are physicians but are still training in psychiatry, and they're under the supervision of a faculty member. For those of you who work at big companies, employee assistance programs through companies are confidential. Most offer like 4 to 6 sessions with a mental health professional, and what they can do is they can kind of help get you started, and then if you need additional help, they can direct you on where to go. Churches or synagogues, and don't get caught up in the religious aspect of this. In Houston, we have a program called Jewish Family Services. It's an excellent program. You do not have to be Jewish. And so don't rule out something that says it's affiliated with a church if you are Jewish, or a synagogue and you're Christian. Don't get caught up in that. I would just call and see what they have to offer. Support groups. I don't remember whether I mentioned this or not, but for people with depression, there's a support group called DBSA. It stands for the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. Those support groups are excellent for depression. To find help finding a therapist, psychologytoday.com lets you enter what kind of therapist you're looking for and also your geographic area, and we'll pull up a list of therapists and descriptions, so it can be a pretty good resource. I do mention DBSA. The only other thing I'd add from this slide is NAMI, the last thing that's listed, is particularly good if you have a friend or family with a serious mental illness like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. There are some free classes that are offered, but there are also some resources for getting psychiatric help for other disorders as well. So with that, did anybody write me any questions?